Moving on to Module 9, Part 3, Testing for Mold Illness. Testing for mold illness is one of the potentially most challenging things to test for in a functional medicine space because there really is not a perfect diagnostic test for mold illness yet. So basically, the testing is a combination of first looking for the genetic, the HLA genotypes, to see if they actually exist in the individual. So that's part one. Part two is looking at other markers that very commonly go up when people have the HLA genotype and are exposed to mold, and looking for the common markers that we see elevate. Now, these common markers that we see to elevate with mold illness do not only elevate with mold illness. However, the correlation is very, very high. So if we have a combination of the HLA genotypes plus the markers that commonly go up in mold illness plus mold symptoms, that combination is how we actually make the diagnosis. So that's really important to understand as we go through this. One thing that we will sometimes see people testing for with mold illness is cytochrome C4a. So we are not using in our clinical practice C4a very frequently because there's truly debate about the utility. In talking to mold experts around the country, what I have found is some people think this is extremely useful. Other people think it's junk. And where I have landed at this point and where we have landed is there is some level of correlation between somebody having the HLA genotype for CIRS and having an elevated cytochrome C4a, but it is not as common of a correlation as some other markers that we're going to talk about today. So we don't tend to utilize this one as much as others in our diagnostic process. It's also important to realize, and we want to also share with you, because you may hear about this one when you hear other practitioners talking about mold illness, is that it can elevate with both Lyme and mold. So it's not necessarily that great at differentiating between the two of them. If you are going to use this one, the reference range is that greater than 2,800 is abnormal. And if it's all the way up to 10,000 or more, then it's usually mold and not Lyme. So if you are interested in using this one, this is how you use it, is you would test this and you say greater than 2,800, abnormal cytochrome C4a. And if you're differentiating between the possibilities of Lyme or mold, really, really high, greater than 10,000, likely mold, somewhere between 2,800 and 10,000, more likely Lyme that is causing it. But it's a pretty gross measurement. Other things that are useful to know, just that other people are doing as far as the testing for mold, is basically testing cytochrome C4a, leaving a house that we think is moldy, giving binders for 5 days, and then retesting. And so this will tell us if, in part, this can give us a sense sometimes if that particular house is moldy, because if this is the case, C4A should respond very, very quickly and come down fast with using binders, which we'll talk about more in the treatment section. If you're going to do this particular test as a way of determining if a house is moldy, it's really important that you do not go anywhere that you do not know the safety on. So it's important that if you were to do this, you would go to another house or another location that you know beyond a shadow of a doubt is safe, and that you're not going anywhere, to the grocery store, to the gym, to church, to wherever it is, to work, that you do not know the safety on. Otherwise, it'll ruin this test. And then you can go back into the potential water damaged home or building and retest after 5 days of being there. So if you leave, you give a binder for 5 days and retest C4A and it goes down, and then you return to the house and you are there for 5 days and then you retest the C4A and then it goes up. This is a decent test for basically eliciting a couple things. One, that there is a mold illness happening, and two, that is directly related to the water damaged building that one is living in. So this is a way of exploring testing for mold illness that some people in the profession are doing. So we wanted to share this with you. This, however, is not the way that we do it, just because there's so many components to this. And we feel like if you're going to leave the potential house and go someplace safe, and you have to test that that house is safe, you might as well just test your own house and see what's happening there. If you are going to do this test, it is really important that you're doing it through National Jewish. National Jewish is affiliated with Quest. And National Jewish is testing C4A and caring for this sample in a different way than other lab companies on the market, which will actually impact its reliability. TGF-beta 1, transforming, otherwise known as transcription growth factor beta 1. This particular marker is highly correlated with elevating in mold illness. Therefore, this is a big one we use in our clinical practice. So we start by looking at the HLA genotypes. Then we see, oh, is TGF-beta 1 actually elevated as well? If TGF-beta 1 is elevated, that is giving us a sign, if they have that HLA genotype, that they do have mold illness. What TGF-beta 1 does in health is it regulates wound healing, muscle development, and Treg cells. So it can also activate autoimmune disease. And so basically what will happen with mold illness is that TGF-beta 1 will go up if somebody is acutely exposed to mold. The debate about a utility is just in relationship to this whole principle that I'm explaining of there is no one perfect marker for illustrating mold illness. So basically with TGF-beta 1, it's the most common marker we see change in mold illness. If somebody has the HLA genotypes, we will test TGF-beta 1 to see if that's elevated. If TGF-beta 1 is not elevated, then we move on to testing another marker that is commonly elevated, which is MMP9. Now, in everybody that we have suspected mold illness for, in just about everybody, we have seen TGF-beta 1 or MMP9 elevate. So TGF-beta 1 we see almost all the time. It's definitely the most reliable indicator. The range for people with the HLA genotype is going to be much different than the range you see reported on the lab. The range reported on the lab actually goes up to about 6,000. And the range as far as healthy individuals with the HLA genotype is going to be 2380 or lower as far as that that level. So this is an example of a positive test. So you can see here this person has an 8533. Now, the reference interval you can see is 66-62. So this is what I'm saying is like the reference range, even though you see it go up this high, if somebody has that HLA genotype, we actually are going to consider anything other than a 2380 to be an elevated level. And I've seen people even at like a 3000 still have significant mold symptoms and exposures. I've seen these things go up. The highest one I saw in the person that was losing hair that I talked about in lesson two, the highest one I saw for that person was a 28,000. But I've seen very, very significant symptoms at 8,500, at 6,000, and occasionally even as low as 3,000, which if we were using the reference interval you see here, we would think that was normal, but it's not. So here's that 28,000 that I saw on that person that was losing their hair in that story. So MMP9 is matrix metallopeptidase 9, and matrix metallopeptidase 9 also can elevate in mold illness. So if I'm highly suspecting mold illness based upon the symptoms and because of the HLA genotype and TGF-beta 1 is normal, I will actually check MMP9. And we currently have two people right now, one with ALS, another with dementia, which could be early onset Alzheimer's, not sure, but definitely diagnosed dementia. And both of these people have a normal TGF-beta 1, an elevated MMP9, positive HLAs, and their house is moldy. So we are working on mold illness right now for these people. And I just want to throw this out there because one curiosity I currently have is for people that have really, really severe mold illness, even though TGF-beta-1 is showing it most of the time in most people. My curiosity is in severe mold illness, is it possible that in those people, MMP9 has more of a tendency to elevate than the TGF-beta-1? So that's just a curiosity right now. But if you see the TGF-beta-1 normal, it is worth testing people for MMP9. And if you see the elevated in HLAs plus the MMP9 plus the mold symptoms, they probably have mold illness. What MMP9 does is it breaks down extracellular matrix. So that's basically why we see some of the symptoms that we do when with mold illness when MMP9 is elevated as part of the mechanism is because the extracellular matrix of the cells are being broken down. So again, with MMP9, similar to TGF-beta-1, the reference range is different in treating mold illness than in the lab standard values. So we're looking for normal as below 350. So we see here we have a 268. So that one is considered normal, but look at their reference range here. It's a 984. So again, if we're going to use the reference range the lab gives, as well as, you know, what is common in most functional medicine tests, we will actually see a lot of people that have a positive value that's missed. So this is normal because it's less than that 350, but make sure that we're using that 350 or less as the proper reference range. MSH is melanocyte-stimulating hormone. It does have a negative effect on the HPA axis and can actually downregulate cortisol production, which is part of why we can see chronic fatigue with a mold illness. It actually also has a negative effect on reproductive hormones and can downregulate the HPO and the HPT, T for testes, not for thyroid, axis as well. The range here is 35 to 81 during recovery stage. So this part is really, really, really important. And this is an area where you'll see people in the mold field debate a lot about this topic of where MSH should be. Now, Dr. Shoemaker, who's coined as being and credited for one being the person who really started doing the research and discovery of the water damaged buildings and their negative effects, and so much respect and so much gratitude for this man's work. One of the things that he does with his treatment is he really pushes MSH super, super, super high and basically says that, hey, you need a 35 to 81 in order for people to feel better. And he's doing that, I believe, in part because that's where we're seeing MSH then all of a sudden creating a more positive effect on the HPA and axis and reproductive hormones, because it's the MSH lowering, the MSH being too low, that's going to cause problems for the HPA and reproductive hormones. So my debate about that approach is when we're doing functional medicine work and we're not just using drugs to manipulate numbers like Shoemaker has done in his work, when we're doing more of a functional medicine approach, I do not see that there's ever a need to push people to this level. In fact, research has shown that the average MSH reported for health when people are feeling really good is a 14. And what I've seen and when I've tested mold illness people for MSH, people do feel really bad when they're at an 8 or a 10. But once we start getting people to a 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, I've seen people feel completely and totally normal. And I think that's because the way that we are recommend treating mold illness is not really to give drugs to basically manipulate things like MSH or some of these other values, but actually to go in and say, okay, well, if there's a negative, if there's a down regulation of the HPO axis, perhaps we give somebody Chase Tree, like we talked about in the reproductive hormone section, to really help with that HPO axis. If somebody is experiencing an HPA axis dysregulation, then perhaps we're using something like licorice or rhodiola, like we talked about in the adrenal section. So in treatment of mold illness, rather than using things to manipulate lab values, by actually understanding that mold illness is going to cause an HPA and an HPO and an HPT axis dysregulation, and we go in and we do all of the great things that we've already talked about in these other modules to really help improve mold, or to improve these other areas of the body affected by mold illness, that we don't see that we need to push an MSH to this high level. But for those of you that are interested in learning more about Shoemaker's protocol and that approach, that is the range that he uses for MSH. So this one's a 28. And somebody at a 28, one of the biggest things I would ask them is to figure out, are there adrenal-related symptoms? Looking at the cortisol values, running something like a Dutch test, looking at the reproductive hormones, looking at, testosterone and estrogen and progesterone, and see what these things are, and see if we can actually fix some of these root causes that have been, or these root abnormalities that have been created by that mold illness. So let's talk about the genotypes now. So genes DRB1, DRB3, DRB4, DRB5, and DRBQ on chromosome 6 are the genetics that can actually lead to mold illness. And a certain combination of these genes will increase the likelihood of mold reactivity. So the test to run through a company like LabCorp is just the HLA-DR test. Now, when we get these results back, this is what they're going to look like. It's going to be a bunch of mumbo jumbo looking stuff. So then what we do is we actually go to this website. This website is myhousemakesmesick.com. And then if you go to myhousemakesmesick.com, you can choose from the Hurts Me tab that will show up. And the Hurts Me is information on testing the house, we'll talk about in a moment. Or you can choose the HLA-DR tab. So you might want to take a moment right now to pause this, to go to myhousemakesmesick.com and bookmark that page and actually click on that link that says HLA-DR on that site, so you know what I'm talking about here. So I would recommend pausing now and doing that. Okay, so now we have this test example. So in this test example, what you can see is HRB1, I don't know why that's hard for me to say right now, HRB1, you see that O4 there, and then you see nothing all the way down as far as numbers until you get to DRB401. So on myhousemakesmesick.com, we are going to put in DRB14. So you can see that came from that first line here, DRB104, and we stick that here, DRB104. And then we see the next one that comes up is DRB401. And you can see we stick in that 01 here. And again, we do that for this one towards the bottom, DQB103. Same thing at the bottom, DQB103. So once you got all these answered, you would then hit calculate. And then once we calculate, then we basically get this code that is spit out by that combining of those particular haplotypes. So what we see here is this person is multi-susceptible chronic fatigue. So you can hit that tell me more button, and then this particular website will tell you more about it. And that's an option. I'm going to tell you more about it here, which is a multi-susceptible gene is going to be susceptible for having problems with their immune system, actually seeing and recognizing way more than just mold. So they're going to have problems with Lyme toxins. They're going to have even problems with, for example, like snake venoms, spider brown recluse venom. So if like somebody with this multi-susceptible gene were to be bitten by a poisonous snake or a poisonous spider, they would actually have less chances of surviving or less time until death until somebody without this particular gene, because their immune system's not going to recognize this and the toxin's going to have a much quicker effect. So another way you can actually calculate these, if you are interested, is you can do a manual calculation. So if you want to do a manual calculation, you can go do that with this particular site. I recommend myhousemakesmesick.com because it is very easy. If you are doing a manual calculation, that site will tell you exactly how to do it. The one exception is when you have a DRB103, you will use a translation code. So I'm going to go back to this example here. So here, if one of these DRB3s, or I'm sorry, if one of the DRB1s was an 03, what would happen is under that 03, you will see this translation code. So you see this translation code under the DRB1. If it was an 03, you would use that translation code. And what you're doing is you're actually plugging in, if you see a 3.01 in that translation code, you will plug in a 17. If you see a 302, you'll plug in an 18. This will make a lot more sense if you go to biotoxinjourney.com/deciferinghladrlabs. So that is not something to spend a lot of time on because the My House Makes Me Sick does such a good job. But I wanted to put this in here with this translation code so that you have something to refer to just in case the My House Makes Me Sick.com ever goes away. Then know that you can have this as a backup thing and using this translation code, which makes sense if you go to that website. So in addition to the multi-susceptible pattern, other things that could be spit out when you put in those codes, you could see purely just mold susceptible spit out, which just means that that person is really only from a genetic standpoint susceptible to not being able to recognize those mold toxins, that toxins from other things they would recognize. So the multi-susceptible gene's the worst. There's a few different versions of the multi-susceptible. One other thing you could see is you could see something like low MSH actually come up as a genetic haplotype. So what that means is that particular person has a tendency to have a lower MSH, and that low MSH could put somebody more susceptible to having something like adrenal fatigue because of the influence of MSH positively on the HPA axis. So for if somebody does not have mold illness or a multi-susceptible, but just has an MSH show up genetically speaking, that's where we should really consider that they might have a reproductive hormone issue or a HPA axis issue because of that low MSH. And if that MSH is actually turned on, if that actual haplotype is, say, expressed, that in that situation, we might consider if somebody has chronic fatigue, keeping them on continual adrenal support to give their HPA axis support because of that MSH showing up. Another question that comes up with testing is correlation between HLAs for mold and gluten. So the HLAs for mold and gluten are slightly different haplotypes. So just because somebody has an HLA, we know HLAs we see in gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. And just because somebody has an HLA to be more reactive to gluten does not mean they're going to have an HLA to mold. They are actually different, but they are very, very close. So if somebody does have an HLA to mold, it's definitely worth testing them for gluten sensitivity and vice versa. VEGF is vasoendothelial growth factor. It's important to realize that vasoendothelial growth factor, which is responsible for the growth of new vasculature, can be affected and downregulated with mold illness. So one of the reasons that air hunger occurs with mold illness, where people just feel like, gosh, they cannot get their breath, is because we see a downregulation of VEGF, and therefore we can see a down regulation of perfusion and of oxygen going to our tissues, because we're not growing and maintaining our vasculature in the same sort of way. So our tissues are actually starving of air. And if somebody has low VEGF, which is common with mold illness, one thing we can do is exercise, which of course is very hard for somebody with mold illness, but it can be useful because it can help raise VEGF. Now, this can sometimes be painful though, because it can actually, when we have mold illness, cause protein buildup inside the cell. The range for VEGF. VIP is vasoactive inhibitory peptide, which many people know for its gastrointestinal functions. The range is 23 to 63. VIP is seen to be low oftentimes with people with mold illness. Sometimes what can be done for with VIP is actually to give intranasal compounded VIP. And this can sometimes help reset if there's a final 30% of symptoms. So this is straight out of Shoemaker's protocol. So what can be done with VIP is giving one spray 4 times a day, using alternating nostrils throughout the day. And that's can raise that last final 30% of symptoms. So that's done generally from a compounding agency. It is by far something that we are using every time. Shoemaker, one of the things he's doing for it is he actually has a study that has shown that in the NeuroQuant MRI that he uses to partly diagnose mold illness, where he sees some mold, some very specific changes in the brain from mold, he's actually shown in one study that VIP will reverse some of those brain changes. We are more interested these days in the concept of photobiomodulation. Photobiomodulation is continuous red and near infrared light that is actually applied to the brain using almost like this helmet. We use a photobiomodulation tool called the V-Light, V-I-E-L-I-G-H-T. And that particular light, what it does is it provides that near and continuous red frequency to the brain, which has been shown to reverse Alzheimer's plaques, to improve dementia, to help improve mitochondrial support, to provide systemic antimicrobial support. So that's one of the things that we are hugely using in our practice right now as one of the final steps of working with mold illness. So other considerations, sometimes we see antidiuretic hormone decrease. So somebody starts getting really dehydrated as they urinate more of their water. This can change serum osmolality. We can also see changes in ACTH due to the impact of MSH on the HPA axis. And we can see leptin resistance. So those are other common changes that we see with mold illness. We don't tend to use these as diagnostic things because there's so many different things that can cause changes in any of these markers. So the common way we do, like I mentioned, is we start with measuring the genetics. And then we measure TGF-beta-1 and MMP-9. If they have genetics for mold, mold symptoms, and have an elevation in TGF-beta-1 or MMP-9, we consider it a positive test, and we look for where the source of the mold is coming from. So you can also do urine mycotoxin testing. Vibrant America does this. Real Time Labs does this. Great Plains does this. If you do tests like this, you want a sauna right before the test, ideally. That will help excrete more mycotoxins into the urine instead of them just being in the cells. So this is something that a lot of people are doing, but the problem with a test like this is if anybody that does not have the genes or does not have a CIRS, if anybody goes into a moldy place and their body is, detoxing those mycotoxins in a healthy way, they will still show up in the urine. So the urine is not telling us if somebody has CIRS just because the mycotoxins are there. Mycotoxins can up in the urine because we've had an exposure. A healthy person without a problem has an exposure and their body is getting rid of it. So the problem is not when the body gets rid of it. The problem is when the body does not get rid of it. And the urine mycotoxin test is not really illustrating that. So that's why we don't recommend doing the urine mycotoxin test as a way of diagnosing this particular condition. So now let's talk about home testing. So Hertzmeyer ERMI are done by tests called Micrometrics or Envirobiomics. We personally use Micrometrics as the lab company we use. So it's important to realize with home testing that moles that are less than 3 micrometers do not fall out of the air and are therefore not seen on dust samples. It's also important to realize that some other molds are heavy, and so they do fall out of the air, and they are therefore not seen in air samples. So 10, and when we diagnose and we're actually looking at a Hertzmeyer and reading a Hertzmeyer, the lab reference ranges as you interpret them, 10 or less is usually going to be safe. For, and what I mean by safe is somebody, if we test somebody's house and they have a Hertzmeyer score of 10 or less, the house is usually going to be safe. So yes, that means there's some mold there. There's going to be mold in every space. We cannot completely eliminate mold from our environment. The problem is when mold gets too high of levels that it becomes a toxic problem. So less than 10 or less than 10 is usually safe. If the home tests between 11 to 15, it's borderline. Some people with these genetics can be fine with 11 to 15. Other people are very sensitive. I tend to find more than not people that have these genetics with 11 to 15 they do tend to be reactive. And then 10 plus is likely going to be bad for everybody with upregulated genotypes. So just like we looked at My House Makes Me Sick for the HLA-DRs, we can look at myhousemakesmesick.com for the home testing. So we run a Micrometrics Hertzmeyer test. It's a dust cloth sample that we use for that. And then we basically have them submit that, and this is the result that we will get. So we'll get, these are the 5 different molds that are being tested for here, some of the most toxic molds, on a Hertzmeyer. So this is what it'll look like. Then we stick it in the calculator. So if you go back to myhousemakesmesick.com and click on Hertzmeyer, I suggest you pause and do that now. So if you've done that, you can see that we can take scores from a test result like this, and we can stick them into this calculator, and then we hit calculate. So as we hit calculate for this particular result, we get a 24. And a 24, like I mentioned, is likely going to be bad for all upregulated genes. So if you get a 10 or less when you hit calculate it, that's when you know that the home is probably safe. It's also good at that point to consider any workspaces or any spaces that they are spending a lot of time as having a huge toxin level. It's also important to realize that some people have this mold built up in their body from previous exposures because of their genes. Now, if they don't have a present exposure, they will probably present as, hey, this used to be worse. I did get a little bit better, but it's still here. There's still problems. Because when we take people out of a moldy environment that are sensitive, even without treatment, they tend to feel better if they're not continuing getting exposures. They might not feel all the way better. And so a common suspicion, if you don't see it in their house and we're wondering, well, do I need to start testing their workplace? That's when we say, do you feel better or worse than you did a year ago? If they are feeling worse than they did a year ago, they are probably still getting exposed someplace. And if it's not in their house, we need to figure out if it's in their work. If they're feeling, say that, oh, I actually feel better than I did a year ago, but I just still can't get to the bottom of this, then it's highly likely that they had some other exposure in the past, that they are safe now, and we can go ahead and detox. If we're not sure, always best to just test their work. So while the Hertzmeyer and the ERMI is basically a larger version of the Hertzmeyer, more expensive version of the Hertzmeyer. The Hertzmeyer does a pretty good job of letting us know about safety. Now, the Hertzmeyer is kind of a broad, say, spectrum way of telling if there's a mold problem. So the Hertzmeyer, when you order these tests to start selling to your patients, they're really simple. They come with just like a cloth, and you'll let dust accumulate on the patient's surfaces to tell them we don't want to dust for about 3 weeks, so things accumulate. They want to basically make sure that they are collecting new dust, right? Because if there was an old mold problem that actually got fixed somehow, perhaps before they moved in, and dust is really old, and we collect that dust, say if we go up to an attic and collect dust that could be potentially old dust, it might be talking about an old problem, not a new problem. So a way of doing this is dust the house, allow dust to settle for 3 weeks, and then collect at that point. So you know the dust that's actually there and any mold spores that have fallen in the dust are new. So then you collect that dust on the cloth. Now the cloth kits basically will say, hey, only collect from one space. We tend to have people collect from 3 or 4 spaces. This leads to a problem of saying, well, we don't know that if there's a positive and where exactly this is coming from. But we feel that regardless, we're going to get a professional into our clinical office. And that professional is going to basically, or not into our clinical office, into the patient's home, and that professional is going to basically figure out and look through the entire house for where that mold could be coming from. So all we're trying to do with the Hurts Me is just have a basic thing saying, is there likely mold present? Do we need to call in the professionals? So that's why we wind up taking dust from several places. And the places we take dust from are the places that we feel that are more likely to be contaminated with mold. So if there's ever been a leak, or there's places that are more water involved as far as bathrooms or laundry rooms, if we see condensation around windows anywhere, those kind of places we want to test. So the Hurts Me is going to measure particles of 0.5 microns or smaller. And a link to an interview about this process. Here's a link to this. So when you go to your documents and your resources section for this particular module and you download this PDF, you can copy and paste this link into your browser. And this is a great interview that's going to talk more about the Hurts Me test. So if you want more information about how to do this, this is a great resource. Okay, so petri dish testing is another thing you'll hear come up in mold illness. People will want to use petri dish testing. They'll stick petri dishes out and they'll think this was going to tell them about mold. This is a problem because some toxic molds are light enough to be found in the air but not land in petri dishes, so they're not going to be tested. Also, some molds that are not toxic will grow in the petri dish and they could crowd out more toxic mold. So we could have all this mold, we test the mold and we say, oh, none of the mold's growing here. That's actually a problem. But it's not, it's like it grows so rapidly that it crowds out other toxic molds from growing. And so we don't actually know. So I don't actually recommend petri dishing. It's not very reliable. It's also good to know that stacky botrys cannot be found in an air sample. So it's air samples are not very reliable. So wherever you live, if you're going to start treating mold illness, what I recommend doing is calling around to some local mold specialties so you can start finding people that know about mold illness. Now, as you call around, one of the things that you're looking for is you want to find people that are going to take both air samples and dust samples and have ways of figuring out if there's mold behind walls. For example, one technique that some mold inspectors will do is drill a tiny hole, very tiny hole, into a wall, and they'll put a little contraption back there to collect like a little piece of metal that'll go through the wall that'll actually collect dust samples behind the wall. And so then they'll pull that piece of metal out and they'll test the dust samples and they'll be able to know what's happening behind the walls. So those are some questions to ask people if you're trying to figure out if a remediator is a good remediator. I recommend if you're going to start testing and treating mold that you do find some good remediators that actually understand the biological effects of mold, because a lot of remediators on the market are not following biological standards and they're just coming in, they're putting a couple petri dish tests down, they're testing the air a little bit sometimes, and they're just saying somebody's, you know, people are good, maybe testing humidity levels, or they're doing this thing of comparing just outdoor molds with indoor molds, which is not really giving us an accurate idea if there is truly a mold problem. So we need to basically figure out if somebody, how they're testing, making sure they're doing air, making sure they're doing dust, making sure they have a way of looking behind the walls and are understanding the biological effects of this and are not just relying on humidity and air samples as a way of testing. I have a patient right now who didn't use a recommended person that we recommended, and this mold person is just putting petri dishes around the house, and she's telling me that, you know, that everything's fine because the petri dishes are fine. As you can see with this, that is not giving us any good relationship or any good reliable information. So to sum up the testing, big things to focus on here. I realize this is a lot of information. Big things to focus on here are, one, making sure the house is safe, using a Hertzme test. If the house is not safe, getting a reliable remediator in. So that's, we're doing that if somebody is positive for the genetics and has a high TGF-beta-1 or a high MMP-9. So those are the basic things. Knowing that you're doing the HLA genotypes, the TGF-beta-1, and the MMP as your best diagnostic measures along with symptoms. And then before you move into treatment, making sure you're testing the house and or the workspace using a Hertzme test to make sure that the house or workspace are all safe. And that is testing for mold. That's part 3 coming up, part 4.